escalation could reignite a cycle of violence that will be difficult.
Grunberg also called for humanitarian aid to Yemen, but mentioned nothing about the lifting of the Saudi blockade, which is the main obstacle preventing vital aid and food supplies from entering the country. This military general we spoke with on the streets of the Yemeni capital says the United Nations is the root cause of all evil in Yemen.
The UN destroys every country they get involved in. Look at what they did in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Sudan. As for Yemen, the United Nations and all of its envoys' efforts in Yemen have been directed at spying on Yemenis, instigating conflicts among Yemenis and fueling chaos and instability.
Some Yemenis are calling on their government to abandon all political talks with the UN. They accuse the UN of complicity with the Saudi-led coalition in the killing of Yemenis. The Yemeni government stated that if the blockade is not lifted and salaries are not paid, the only option left is war.
The Yemeni people and government have expressed that the 8-year Saudi-imposed siege on Yemen must be broken by any means necessary. This after years of failed political efforts to resolve the conflict by the United Nations, an entity which most Yemenis lost trust in and accused of supporting the Saudi military aggression on Yemen. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Tehran has hosted the first International Congress on Influential Women. The 2-day event is underway in the Iranian capital with the participation of influential, active and elite women from almost 90 world countries. Addressing the Congress, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi called on the participating women at the Congress to benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran with regard to women's rights.
We hope that the participants of this Congress, through cooperation and interaction, will be able to take necessary measures for the rights of women in the world and benefit from the experiences of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the field of protecting women's rights and paying special attention to women's role in the society. I hope this Congress will prepare the ground for further cooperation among countries in this field.
The event is aimed at identifying, supporting and developing the abilities and capabilities of elite and influential women at national and international level.
Women are suffering worldwide. This is just because we have not been together. And most importantly, this is the very first time for the Islamic country of Iran to host such a big occasion. So I am so happy to be here, and I hope the relationship with our sisters, women in the world, we should work hard, very strongly, and look forward to the international world to assist women than ever before.
It is extremely important to integrate women in peace-building process. So this conference is extremely important because we know that we have a peace threatened in many parts of the world. And when we look for solutions, women should be involved.
Special awards with international recognition are slated to be granted to influential women in 3 fields of science and technology, economic and social affairs.
The Congress International of the Women, it's very important for the women in the Islam. For the development, the communication, the country, for example, Algeria, the women Algeria and the women Iraq, and we take the relation very important because the Islam, it's number one.
The influential women have been selected from among housewives, women employees, female social activists, as well as competent women in digital technology, social media, science and technology, entrepreneurship, and those who are pioneers in areas of culture and charity affairs.
On the sidelines of the Congress, a memorandum of understanding was signed among Afghanistan's neighboring countries at the initiative of Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs to help Afghan girls and women continue their education. Sama Kujuri, Tehran.
The heads of the main EU institutions defended the 27-nation bloc's foreign policy during a debate in the European Parliament on Wednesday. They insisted that sending deadly weapons to Ukraine, costing billions of euro, is the only way to thwart Russia. Most lawmakers agree, but not all.
We see militarization, we see escalation. We are not really seeing a call for peace. We assume it will be the people who suffer the cost of sanctions.
Interest rates continue to rise in the eurozone and inflation remains extremely high. Sanctions against Moscow and the rapid move away from Russia's energy are the main reasons.
The cost of the living crisis affecting our European citizens unfortunately persists, and we are therefore concerned that the European Council conclusions fail to prioritise the support for our citizens.
Experts warn public support in the EU for the seemingly never-ending cash flow to Ukraine will eventually wane if the war persists, resulting in political consequences.
There can be a kind of danger, which is already looming, that very populistic parties, they can use this as an argument to say, look, this is something we have to cater for our own needs first, and then we have to see what's going to happen in Ukraine.
In an unprecedented departure from diplomacy on Wednesday, the European Council President Charles Michel accused authorities in Iran of operating a, quote, brutal regime. He says more sanctions against Tehran will be announced on Monday. Some lawmakers oppose the policy.
The EU and its partners never stop violating international law, going above multilateral institutions like the UN with their own parallel systems, including punishing millions of people around the world through our authoritarian unilateral sanction regime.
By insisting that rioters in Iran are peaceful protesters and by attempting to directly implicate the Islamic Republic in the Ukraine war, impartial analysts say the EU is being opportunistic, suggesting the new sanctions are trumped up and politically motivated. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
From hero to zero, and claps don't pay the bills. Some of the chants by nurses here and across the country on strike again in a dispute with government over not just pay, but patient safety. Emma has been a nurse for more than three decades.
For a long time, we've felt we haven't been able to give the care we want to give because we're so pressed for time, resources, simply just numbers on the ground. So I think for a long time, we've wanted things to change, and it's come to the point where this something has to change, and this is really our only option. Nothing else is working.
The reason behind that, more than 10 years of underfunding and neglect.
Across the country, the health service has been facing what's been described as an intolerable and unbearable strain due to a combination of COVID, the seasonal flu, and staff shortages, with some patients having to wait up to 24 hours for a bed inside a hospital such as this one.
That plus a record 7 million patients on the NHS waiting list, described as a national scandal. The Royal College of Nursing Union demanded a 19% pay rise when they first went on strike last year, but has since cut that in half. Yet a deal is yet to be reached. The Health Secretary, James Cleverly, says the strikes put patients' lives at risk. Last week, the government introduced legislation that, if passed, will enable employers to sue unions and fire employees if they refuse to work on strike days.
Rather than talking about the pay negotiation, talking about safer staffing and the safety and quality of care that we're giving up and down the country in our hospitals, the government have gone down this sort of anti-strike, anti-trade union route. So, once again, so it's interesting to talk about safe staffing levels on a strike day, but what about the other 365 days in the year when we have not enough nurses on duty, not enough doctors, not enough physiotherapists, cancellations of operations and delayed chemotherapy? What about those days? What about safer staffing on a normal NHS day?
The UK has been hit by months of public sector strikes from rail to mail, all of whom say they're in for the long haul. In the weeks ahead, more strikes are planned by nurses, paramedics, and ambulance drivers, with the Royal College of Nursing warning it'll be their biggest walkout yet if pay talks with the government do not progress soon. Saeed Purza, London.
Gaza, the symbol of resistance. This is the title of the conference held in Tehran. Attended by Iranian officials and members of Palestinian resistance groups, the event seeks to shed light on Palestinian suffering under more than 7 decades of Israeli occupation, with Gaza bearing the title of an icon for the struggle for freedom.
Gaza, the 360 square kilometer, besieged over 17 years maybe, and with this dire situation, the people over there were managed to steadfast, to confront the continuous aggressions and offensive from the Israeli forces against our civilians, against our common people in Gaza.
The event is held on the anniversary of the 22-day resistance in the Gaza Strip in late 2008 and early 2009, where Palestinians resisted Israel's military offensive.
Today was the day that in Iran we remember the resistance of the Palestinian people in Gaza district after the invasion of the Israeli troops in 2008. On that year, the Israeli troops invaded oppressed people of the Palestinian in Gaza district. And in Iran, every year we remember that.
This year's edition of the annual conference seeks to recognize late Iranian General Qasem Soleimani's role in strengthening the resistance axis in Palestine.
When we talk about freedom, when we talk about resistance, when we talk about Palestine, you cannot miss the name of Shahid Soleimani. Shahid Soleimani is a big icon for us in Palestine and resistance movement to defend our own legitimate right. Shahid Soleimani was a big brother to us.
General Soleimani was killed along with his fellow comrades in January 2020 near Baghdad International Airport in a drone strike launched by the U.S. The Iranian military commander spearheaded major operations in Syria and Iraq that led to the defeat of Daesh and recapturing of key areas from the terror group.
People here say General Soleimani was a key element in the resistance front, who had plans to liberate Palestine from the Israeli occupation. They say this was a major reason why the U.S. assassinated him. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former EU lawmaker Pierre Antonio Panzeri was among those arrested by Belgian police last month as part of a probe into a cash-for-favours scheme allegedly involving Qatar and Morocco. He has just signed a deal with prosecutors to name names in return for a reduced sentence. On Tuesday, during a debate in the European Parliament on the scandal, the EU itself was accused of corruptly targeting some of its own member states.
No peace without justice. Whose secretary has been arrested for corruption? This organization was financed by the EU, France and Germany. What a coincidence, because this very organization focused on attacking Poland.
Belgian police have recovered more than €1.5 million in cash following dozens of raids. So far, the scandal mainly involves members of the S&D political grouping in the European Parliament.
Since the accusations emerged in December, we in the Socialists and Democrats group have been working intensively to try and implement reforms to combat corruption. We have to ensure accountability, transparency and integrity.
Sitting Greek MEP Eva Kaili is among four currently behind bars awaiting trial. Lawmakers are demanding that an EU-wide ethics body is established. Aside from the Parliament scandal, each year millions of euro go unaccounted for from the EU budget. This as ordinary citizens struggle to make ends meet.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Some lawmakers say the EU is showing a great deal of hypocrisy, given that so much is said here about rule of law problems elsewhere. Sources tell us Belgian police will almost certainly be making more arrests in the coming days as part of the European Parliament corruption probe. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. is covertly sponsoring Daesh terrorists. That is a claim that Moscow has made when it comes to the Daesh in Afghanistan. But why would the U.S. do that? Russia says the U.S. wants to take revenge on the Taliban for its defeat. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether our guests agree on this stance by Russia. We'll also take a look at other instances of U.S. support for Daesh terrorists and what gains the U.S. was looking for with this association, which, based on its track record, has not been anything substantial. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Kovalik, professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joins us from Pittsburgh, PA. Also joining us is Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Daniel Kovalik, first over to you. So the U.S. reaching out to armed groups that oppose the Taliban and also secretly giving money to Daesh, that is what Russia's presidential envoy for Afghanistan has said. What do you think?
Well, I mean, why would anybody be surprised by this? The U.S., of course, was the one that supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, beginning actually in mid-1979, before the Soviet Union had a presence there. And, of course, the Mujahideen was a jihadist terrorist group. One of its leaders, of course, was Osama bin Laden, who went on to form al-Qaeda. So the U.S. has been working with terrorist groups, certainly as far back as the 80s. And since then, we know that the U.S. and NATO, you know, partnered with jihadists in Libya to overthrow Gaddafi. They then helped those same jihadists in Libya to travel to Syria to try to overthrow Assad. And the U.S. supported jihadists in Syria against Assad. So this is really par for the course for the United States.
Okay, this is where, Fra Hughes, we need to have you help us or help the ones who are not a believer of this or who do not accept this association between the U.S. and terrorist groups as to how that does happen. Because Daniel Kovalik talked about how it supported jihadists in Libya, then jihadists in Syria. His word was jihadist. We call them terrorists. As to how the U.S. Has done this and why it has done this and why did it resort to the terrorist formula as it saw?
Well, firstly, if you take a look at American history, I mean, America claims to have got its freedom from the British Empire in 1776. And then for 225 years, out of 247 years of American modern history as an independent state, America has been at war with its neighbors or somewhere else within the globe. So not American people, but the American administration and the people behind these wars and the bankers for 225 years have been profiteering from war and profiting from the misery and the death and the maimings that they bring to other sovereign nations. I mean, you could even throw Ukraine into this. I mean, a lot of people believe it's a proxy war. The Americans are going to fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood in order to destabilize Russia. So if we take that as the most recent example and just move backwards, we can see that America uses proxy armies in order to carry out its dirty work when it's frightened to get its own boots on the ground. Indeed, there were instances in Syria where the Americans supposedly were dropping arms to their allies within Syria, which unfortunately and kind of uncontrollably fell into the path of Daesh. And the Syrian army has claimed before that their positions have been attacked by American forces prior to Daesh ISIS assaults on their positions. So, you know, there is a history of this. There is a history of the proxy wars where the American administration uses other people to carry out their fights. And one other example would be when America and its allies invaded Iraq. It was about 6 months after the invasion of Iraq that we began to witness the bombings of the various mosques. Now, to my mind, that was used by America and especially Britain in order to sow division and civil war within Iraq. While Iraqis were fighting each other, they were not fighting the occupation. Sure. And I think America wants to see Afghanistan to continue to be disabled because it's on the borders with Iran. And you never know, who they could try and bring to power as a pro-Western puppet regime in the future.
Yeah, we're going to discuss some of those examples in greater detail and maybe even more examples of this U.S. Association with these terrorists in one form or another. Going back to what the Russian envoy has said, and this is pretty interesting, Daniel Kovalik, he has said the Americans have been acting this way, quote, because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation they do everything so that peace is not established in this troubled land. Now, I'm curious as to how this can be understood. I mean, it wasn't bad enough that they occupied the land for over 20 years. It wasn't bad enough that nothing that they promised really panned out. But now that they have pulled out and left the country in tatters, they wanted to destroy it more by supporting this group. I mean, are they supporting then by default these terrorists that are bombing instances where we know that it has led to many civilian deaths?
Well, yes, I think that is probably the case. And again, this seems to be the current modus operandi of the United States in its foreign policy, particularly in West Asia. When you look at the wreckage that the U.S. and NATO have left behind in a place like Libya, which was a very stable country under Gaddafi, very prosperous. Of course, the U.S. and NATO bombed that country to smithereens, left it broken. Now there's slaves being sold in public markets. Libya may never be restored to a stable country. The same can be said of Iraq. The same can be said of Afghanistan itself. It seems that actually destruction is the goal many times. And why would that be? I don't think it's purely out of spite, though in the case of Afghanistan, there was probably some of that. But it's because the U.S. has decided that it's easier to rule and to exploit other people's resources and labor if there's no unified, stable state that governs, right? I think another example of this is the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the U.S. has supported proxies as well for many years, which have gone in and killed literally millions of Congolese, but again, to maintain instability in that country so that the West can just, plunder the resources there without limit, without having to pay taxes. I think that's what we're seeing. That is U.S. foreign policy.
In the case of Afghanistan, however, just as a segue here, that, Farah Hughes, it appears that the U.S. would have a lot to actually benefit when it has an unstable Afghanistan, given the fact that you have this Russian envoy stating what it has in terms of the U.S. terrorist connection, because you have, on the one hand, Iran on the one side, and then you have China. You have also Russia, in a sense, where the Russian envoy has actually blamed the U.S. also for wanting to support this because it wants to go after Russia. So the U.S. Can benefit from this association when it comes to three of its, whatever you want to call them, arch foes or what have you. In this case, in point, Afghanistan's destabilization through these terrorists can be a way for the U.S. to get to these countries. Is that one or a correct way of looking at this?
I'm not sure. I would say that there's definitely possibilities for further destabilization of Iran, depending on what parts of the country Daesh in Afghanistan could possibly control with the armaments and the finances coming through from America. America claimed it attacked Afghanistan because of 9/11, but when they put in their puppet president, Mohammad Karzai, at the very beginning, the first actual kind of presidential decree he signed, I believe, was an order to allow a gas pipeline to travel through Afghanistan. That may have been previously banned or not the case under a previous regime. I agree. I don't think it's about revenge. America cares nothing about Afghanistan or the Afghan people. I believe when they pulled out, they were purely pivoting towards China. So they've withdrawn their forces in Afghanistan in order to regroup both for Ukraine and for any forthcoming kind of action against or to China. So I think that's why they left. I mean, America could have stayed on in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban had the countryside, but the Allies and the Americans had the cities. So they could have just stayed in perpetuity with a low-level war in order to plunder the resources of Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But I think they have, you know, they have their chess pieces on the global board. And if we look even further back, you know, when America was focused on Latin America, we had dictators and people that were supported brutal dictatorships, brutal right-wing fascist regimes that tortured and murdered and disappeared their own citizens. That was all with the backing of America. So America, as it changes its foreign policy, following its, you know, its eye on where it's looking to exploit next, then that's why we have seen the war in Ukraine, the wars in West Asia, and potential wars going forward with a potential proxy with Taiwan and Japan against China. So it's a very dangerous, very sinister campaign that that the American administration is following.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, and Danny Kovalik, when we first started out, you talked about the statements made by the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in terms of the Mujahideen, I think is what you said. And interestingly, in some sense, back in 2014, the former U.S. President Barack Obama hosted a two-day strategy meeting. I'm looking at this one particular case in point, where he met with the intelligence chiefs of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan, and some other Middle Eastern countries. And what the purpose of that meeting was, this two-day security meeting, was to refocus military aid away from the al-Nusra Front and, well, they call it ISIS, we call them Daesh, towards more moderate groups of what they called rebels. So when you take a look at the type of involvement with these terrorist groups through its allies, okay, we're seeing an extensive penetration that they had, not penetration, connection that they had with these groups in a variety of levels and based on a variety of different terrorist groups. And of course, that was 9 years ago, back in 2014. These types of relationships have been going on for quite some time, right?
Well, yeah, and I believe it was in 2014 that Joseph Biden, then vice president, said that there were no moderate rebels in Syria, and that therefore the rebels we were supporting were not moderate, meaning they were in fact the very terrorists we claimed we were fighting against. In fact, that could be said about the Free Syrian Army, which the U.S. openly supported for a time, and which committed terrorist acts in Syria, including trying to destroy Christian churches in cities like Malula and Homs and elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, we know for sure that the support for those types of groups goes back that far and even farther. You know, Seymour Hersh, who won the Pulitzer Prize, a great Western journalist, he wrote an article back in, I want to say, 2007, maybe, saying that even by like 2005, George W. Bush had pivoted away from fighting terrorism to actually at times partnering with terrorists to try to weaken Syria, weaken Iran. And let's remember, the U.S. Has supported the MEK over time, the MEK being a terrorist group that's killed tens of thousands of Iranian civilians. So, again, nothing is surprising about this. This is par for the course. The sad part is that few Americans realize it, but the truth is out there. And again, there's officials in the U.S. government who at times have admitted this.
Sad part, I think, sadder even than that, is the fact that we here in the Islamic Republic are being labeled as terrorists. Not we, but the government. That's a whole other topic for another Spotlight program. Okay, so the U.S., Frahues, has a base in Syria. Not far from it, there are terrorists that are there. And for years now, even though it's illegally occupying that part of Syrian territory, it's been saying that it's there to eradicate terrorists. Why doesn't it get rid of the terrorists there? Why is it that, for example, Russia has said that the Al-Tanf military base, terrorists are roaming freely around in that area, and also has accused the U.S. of training some of these terrorists? What do you think of those statements from Russia?
Firstly, I'd have to say I've always been very impressed by the spokespeople that the Russian government has fronting their foreign policy. They seem to be people of integrity, people of honor, and people of honesty, and who refreshingly appear to tell the truth and paint the picture as it's seen on the ground in Syria and Ukraine and Afghanistan and anywhere they choose to see what's happening under kind of Western imperialism. I believe fully that America will be training the Daesh terrorists in Syria. They're still there stealing the wheat of the Syrian people. They're still there stealing the oil. So we're back to the wars for profit that continually seems to be the background to these conflicts. I would fully believe that America is not only training and arming and financing Daesh in Syria, but I would be fairly convinced that they are directing them. The only ointment in the eye here at the moment appears to be Turkey's growing fraternal relationship with Syria and Russia, and it's distancing itself from America, and perhaps it's going to join the new kind of Belt and Road initiative, the new Silk Road, to bring more prosperity and more jobs to Turkey. So I believe the Russians, and I would believe them a lot sooner than I would ever believe one word of a British, European, or American politician or spokesperson.
Let's go back to the year 2012. I know it's a long time ago, Daniel Kovalik, but I'm wondering if you remember this. This was a case that went to trial in London of a Swedish man that was accused of terrorism in Syria. Again, I don't know if you recall that. And you have this man being tried in court, and then all of a sudden, it's not all of a sudden, but then it became clear that the courts were not aware that British intelligence had actually been arming the terrorists that that defendant was charged with. I don't know if you remember that. It was quite a case where later on, based on a particular source, reports were cited that MI6 had cooperated with the CIA on a rat line, as it was called, of arms transfers from Libyan stockpiles to the Syrian terrorists. So that's a clear case in point of how you have different intels of the countries, in this case the U.S. and the U.K., cooperating together to arm terrorists. I know this is, again, old news, but don't you think this serves as a clear case in point of U.S. and, of course, the U.K. Support behind terrorists?
Well, yes, and I don't remember that particular case, but what I do remember is, again, another Seymour Hersh article called Red Lines and Rat Lines about the very phenomenon you were talking about the UK and the US supporting terrorists in Syria. And by the way, Seymour Hersh really, after writing that, had a hard time getting published anywhere because no one in the West wanted to hear the truth about that. The other thing in 2012 was that the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, I believe, they had a classified document that somehow was leaked that, again, admitted that the U.S. was supporting groups in Syria whose intentions were to set up a caliphate in Syria. And so, again, all these things are pretty evident that the U.S. has been secretly supporting these groups for many years.
The question that comes to mind here, it's a very simple question, Frau Hughes, and forgive me if I'm asking this, but why does the U.S. have to subscribe to terrorists? Why doesn't it just go after who it wants to go after, which it does, through its own army? Is it that incapable that it has to subscribe to terrorists?
I think it's possibly cheaper to use someone else. If you remember the Vietnam War with so many American casualties that the American people eventually turned against the administration and demanded that their troops be brought home, that hasn't happened in recent conflicts because we saw shock and awe. What you've actually seen is the America as the number one superpower, having, you know, such a tactical advantage on the rest of the world. I mean, attacking Afghanistan and attacking Iraq and Libya and Syria, these are countries that could not possibly militarily stand up to America. But I do believe it's easier to try and install a proxy government. It's easier to pay other people to do the dirty work and do the fighting. And rather than put a huge amount of American boots on the ground and therefore kind of exposing them to potential attack by, you know, a revolutionary army of national liberation. I mean, when you create Daesh, I believe America created that with Saudi Arabia. So it was, you know, Saudi tech fury, fanatical, kind of fundamentalist Islamists who are following the wrong path in Islam by following the route of terrorism. I mean, they were financed by Saudi Arabia and they were backed by America, and Turkey allowed them to enter into Syria. So there's a little triumvirate there that allowed this war on Syria to take place. So it's easy for the American Congress to vote, you know, to give money to the military budget, and then the black hole that appears in the CIA accountability of those finances and the Pentagon and stuff, they can just run off, buy arms, buy weapons, buy mercenaries, because that's what Daesh is. It's a mercenary army paid for by America and Saudi Arabia. And when you think of the likes of the White Helmets, they were the kind of propaganda wing for Daesh in Syria. I mean, they were started by an ex-MI6 operative, and they were backed by millions of dollars from Britain and from Canada and from America in order to promote the propaganda that they were using around chemical warfare and the barrel bombs that were just supposed to destroy hospitals in Syria. So, you know, if I had the money, I wouldn't go and fight my enemy. I'd probably pay someone else to do it and keep myself safe.
Okay, so the final question goes to you, Daniel Kovalik. Iran has always said that, you know, when you have the foreign countries and their armies in one form or another in this particular region of West Asia, and this is in direct reference to the U.S., that you're going to have these types of activities still prosper in some sense, or still to continue, that is. And of course, the association that we have made in this program of the U.S. with the Daesh terrorists is still one source of instability, which Iran says that the U.S. needs to go. Are we looking at the fact that if the U.S. was to leave the region, that these terrorists would cease to exist?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the sad part, the sad truth is that once you create such monsters, they tend to have a life of their own. We saw that, again, with the Mujahideen, which morphed into Al-Qaeda, which then went on to attack the United States. I don't think that was the plan. I mean, there's a lot of unintended consequences from all this. Now, you'd hope that eventually those things would fizzle out. But again, you know, the U.S. has created monsters that it set loose on the world. And once that happens, it may be hard to control and stop them. And that, again, that is one of the great tragedies of all this.
Thank you very much for that. Daniel Kovalik, Professor of International Human Rights, University of Pittsburgh School of Law from Pittsburgh, PA. Farah Hughes, thank you. Journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatway and the team, it's goodbye.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Iran's domestic production capacities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As you know, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubs every Iranian calendar year with a theme which fits to the conditions of the time. The leader named this year as the year of production, knowledge-based, job-creating. The themes of the year are chosen by Ayatollah Khamenei to motivate the officials and the people towards putting the internal potential capacities into effect to push the country on the course of progress. Thus, we have prepared a series to briefly review Iran's capacities in various fields. As for the third episode of this series, you will be hearing Iran's steel industry. Please stay tuned. The steel industry is one of the fundamentals of every country's economy. Different products of steel are the important elements of various industries. This can be proved with a quick look at houses, offices, and factories. The Islamic Republic of Iran has paid special attention to steel industry. The first steps for construction of a steel factory had been taken in Iran in 1927. But the outbreak of the Second World War hindered the efforts on the plan. Surprisingly, the first steel factory was constructed in Khuzestan province after decades. Thus, in 1963, a factory was built for processing of imported scraps. This factory was built according to an agreement between Iran and a Swedish company. Later, the government sector started activity in the field so that the former Soviet Union undertook the construction of a steel production unit in Isfahan with a capacity of 550,000 tons per year. As a result, the Iranian National Steel Company was founded to work on the construction and equipment of the mines related to the factory, such as iron ore, coal, milestone, and so on. This trend continued in the following years. Yet, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the steel industry highly expanded with the construction of factories in Hormozgan and Khorasan provinces and construction of Sabah Steel, Kavyan Steel, and other smaller units. According to the statistics of the World Steel Association, Iran's annual raw steel production was 1.8 million tons before the Islamic Revolution, while this number reached 29 million tons in 2020. In other words, Iran's raw steel production has increased 16 folds over 40 years. Iran's share of raw steel production was 0.4% before the revolution, whereas this number has reached 1.4%. China produces 54.3% of the raw steel, and India ranks second with 5.6% production. Next producers are Japan, the United States of America, Russia, South Korea, Germany, Turkey, and Brazil. The Islamic Republic of Iran stands in the 10th position. World Steel Association reported in 2022 that Iran's two-month growth of steel production topped among the world producers with 11.8%. During the past decades, the Islamic Republic used to be a buyer and importer of steel and relevant products. But now it has gained the 10th global rank, while it was the 17th producer in 2010. Iran is the first producer of steel in West Asia with over 29 million tons of production. The Islamic Republic enjoys 88 active steel production units with a nominal capacity of 40 million tons per year. Iran has envisaged production of 55 million tons of steel till 2025, while the need of the domestic market to the product is estimated to amount to 20 to 24 million tons annually. With regards to the growth of the domestic steel production, Iran has turned into an exporter in the industry. Now the country is the 16th exporter of steel. China is the destination of nearly 40% of Iran's exports. Indonesia and Ghana are the next importers of Iran's steel with 23% and 6% respectively. In 2018, Iran exported $4.2 billion of steel to 63 nations. The Islamic Republic of Iran has gained the 10th position among the top steel producers in the world in sight of the fact that it has been under the harshest sanctions imposed illegally by the US regime and its hangers-on in Europe. In January 2020, the US Treasury Department sanctioned 14 Iranian steel and iron-producing companies, while it had already sanctioned the giant Mubarakeh company in Isfahan, which produces the major bulk of the country's steel. However, the activities of a steel industry in Iran have made every effort to thwart the illegal sanctions and have indigenized a lot of equipment needed in the industry.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.